So currently we're in the first of the 7 points in the 7-point mind training, which is presenting the preliminary practices, which is the basis for the main Lojong practice. The wisdom and compassion is the main aspect of the practice. So here we saw that to have a good basis for this Lojong practice, we need to have practiced in a systematic order the areas of practices within these three scopes. In particular, we need to have cultivated these four thoughts that we saw as the first four reflections in this prayers for meditation. By reflecting on precious human life and death, that will enable us to appreciate the precious opportunity that we find ourselves in and the fact that this is not going to last forever. So these two reflections would inspire us to make our life meaningful, to not waste our life, to not be one of these people later in our life who look back on our life and are full of regrets at having wasted our life. And then the third reflection here, on the karma, the results of my virtuous and non-virtuous actions will without fail ripen within me. That will, of course, motivate us to adopt an ethical lifestyle, which, of course, is the basis of any meaningful life. And then on that basis, the fourth reflection here, there is no genuine happiness to be found within the abodes of samsara. Or in other words, to reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of our existence, to come to realize dukkha. That reflection will help us to stop chasing after genuine happiness out there, to redirect our mind, to turn our mind inward. So these are often called the four thoughts that turn the mind. To turn the mind inwards, to understand that the source of happiness and suffering is within ourselves, and thereby we will correctly practice the true Dharma, that we will really work on trying to overcome the source of suffering in our own mind and to work on cultivating the causes of happiness within our own mind. So these four thoughts are very important as a basis for any practice, and certainly here, in terms of Lojong practice, they are of course equally important to have these as a firm foundation. So not only are we to reflect on each of these four individually to really internalize them, but also, as the commentary here suggests, is that we should practice these. It says here, we should induce enthusiasm at the beginning of your meditation session by contemplating these points. So therefore, we find here in these prayers for meditation these four thoughts coming at the beginning. So therefore, when we do a meditation practice, we can begin by reflecting on these four points to develop enthusiasm for our practice. So that's why we see them appearing here at the beginning. Now, just to wrap up these preliminary practices, again, I'd like to read a little bit from this book again here, The Practice of Lojong by Tralok Gyapgon. And this is on page 27 at the bottom. He says the following. Any expedition requires proper preparation if it is to have some hope of success. If we fail to plan for our travels, we will quickly tire of the journey or abandon it and return home. The same hesitation and lack of endurance can tarnish the spiritual path, which is why it is imperative to thoroughly prepare ourselves for the journey. Practicing these preliminaries serves three functions. They are good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. At the beginning, these contemplations encourage us to propel ourselves into spiritual practice. In the middle, they help us to sustain our practice with diligence and vigor. And at the end, they become an aid to our spiritual fulfillment. Many people think these contemplations are too negative and diminish our zest for life. However, this is a complete misunderstanding of their intended purpose. We are not trying to generate an attitude that will make us turn our backs on the world and lose interest in living. These preliminaries are a skillful method for teaching us to live a purposeful and meaningful life. It is precisely because everything is impermanent that we have the opportunity to bring about positive change in our lives. That's why we should try to create positive change while we can, instead of postponing it to some indefinite time in the future, when our circumstances might suddenly change. From the Buddhist point of view, to live properly is to lead a life without regret. We will have no regrets if we learn to distinguish the essential from the non-essential ways we can conduct our lives and devote ourselves to the essential ones. A regretful life has waste written all over it, while a life fully lived carries all the marks of success. These preliminary meditations are daily reminders of what is important for a meaningful and purposeful life. So I think that's some very good advice. So again, if we find ourselves being lazy when it comes to meditation, when we find ourselves lazy in terms of trying to develop ourselves, if we find ourselves getting caught up in accumulating wealth, possessions, chasing after pleasure, then it's a sure sign we have not really internalized these four reflections. That maybe we have some vague intellectual appreciation of them, but we haven't really reflected on them, we haven't internalized them. So this is a sign that we really need to put some more effort into these reflections so that we can really be inspired to have a meaningful life, not to waste our life, to prioritize our life, to really put effort into the things that are going to bring us a meaningful life. And on that point, I have one more thing I'd like to read out. This is coming as part of a talk that Steve Jobs gave. So I think everyone knows who Steve Jobs is. He was the ex-CEO of Apple. He gave this talk, I think, quite some years ago at Princeton University to the graduates there. Or was it Stanford? One of the two. And he said the following. This is just part of it. He said, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, if you live each day as if it were your last, someday you'll most certainly be right. It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I will be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. Your time is limited, So don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of other people's opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. So I think that these sorts of reflections are very important. And it's a little bit unfortunate they're sort of called preliminaries. Because again, as soon as we hear the word preliminary, we think, oh, that's something I sort of do a little bit at the beginning and then I sort of forget about that stuff and I go on to more advanced things. As Tralok Rinpoche said in this book, these are good in the beginning, in the middle and the end. So we should not think that these are simply something to do as a beginner and then forget about them. But rather we need to continue to reflect on these to have that foundation. And therefore it's very good, as we have here, to do a short reflection on them at the beginning of each meditation session to remind us of these things so that we are inspired not just for the meditation but for that day as well, as Steve Jobs said. So that's the preliminary practices. So these are the sort of core elements to have a foundation for the core practices of Lojong. I think these are the preliminaries or foundations for, if you look in any of the Mahayana traditions, particularly in the Tibetan traditions, you will find these four preliminaries are common throughout in all types of practice, whether it's Lam Rim, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, whatever you're practicing. These are exactly the same four common preliminary practices as the foundation. So is there any more questions about any of those before we move on to the second point? Yeah.
I had a question about the three scopes.
The three scopes, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about. In my understanding, the seven-point mind training comes under the third scope of great.
Correct.
And we need to have a good foundation of first scope and second scope before we actually start practicing this one.
Also, we need to have the root, the foundations of the third scope. Because remember, the third scope, this Lojong, is within the Mahayana, and the third scope is within that level of practice. So not only do we need to be striving for a good future and have that renunciate, the understanding of dukkha, and have renunciation and be striving in these trainings. But also, we need to, in the third scope, we need to start to begin to develop the motivation. So remember the bodhicitta, we had the aspiring and engaging. So first we need to aspire to develop bodhicitta. So we need to have that. And then we need to be trying to actually cultivate bodhicitta and on the basis of those bodhisattva vows. On that basis, then we can really get into this practice more seriously to really cultivate the bodhicitta. So we have to have some sort of basis there, because if we don't have the aspiring bodhicitta and we don't are not trying to actively develop it, then this has no sort of basis or foundation.
So my question actually was because nirvana comes in the middling scope.
Yes.
So unless we have achieved nirvana, we cannot start practicing it. That's what my question.
Yeah, I was hoping someone would ask this question. So remember, these three scopes are like levels of practice. So we can use the analogy of building a three-story house. Do we have to 100% complete the first story before we begin the second story?
No.
But we need a minimum structure there. We need this solid foundation of the first floor before we begin the second. Then, while we're starting to build the second, we can keep working at the first floor to complete it. Same third floor. So in this way, that's why in the preliminaries here it says, They have to have has trained his or her mind in the three scopes in a systematic order and has reached a certain level. A certain level doesn't mean we have to have achieved nirvana. A certain level means that we have to have internalized these. We have to have some sort of experiential renunciation in that way. We have to have a good ethical basis. We have to have really worked on our shamatha practice at some level and have some little taste of no self at some level.
So that probably can be assessed with the teacher, isn't it? That whether we have achieved that certain level.
Yeah.
Because we can't self-determine that.
Well, or I mean, you can sort of see a little bit how you're progressing. Like renunciation, you know, this desire for nirvana,
yeah.
This aspiration for nirvana. You know, if we've internalized it, we should find that we have less craving for pleasures. We're spending less time chasing after more money. We're not working those extra 10 hours of overtime to earn a few extra dollars so we can, you know, buy a BMW, you know, because we desperately need that. We'll find that our priorities will start to shift in life, that we'll find more important is to develop ourselves internally rather than chasing after that. So those sorts of shifts in priorities will be symptomatic of the fact that we're starting to internalize this. You know? So we can at some level, but you're right, is this is why right at the beginning here, it says, you know, what are the preliminaries? It says the practitioner of mind training must be someone who, by relying on a qualified teacher. So what that's saying is that if we want to be most effective in this or any system of practice, a qualified teacher can be very helpful because they can fine tune. They can more clearly see where we are at, what we need to focus on, for how long and so forth. Of course, we can sort of have a little bit of an idea but, you know, we don't, as the first two reflections understand, we don't have unlimited time. So we want to be most effective. And so to help be most effective, a qualified teacher can be very helpful there. Sure.
I have one more question, actually confusing, regarding impermanence.
Yeah.
So I think I get some understanding of impermanence regarding the objects where we can see here, like for example, a cup or any other objects here.
Sure.
What I don't understand is how do I actually see impermanence with regards to human beings? Because that theory should apply there as well.
Sure. And we can apply it. I mean, the basis of the human being, of course, is the body and the mind. I mean, we only have to look at the body. We can see there's a lot of impermanence going on, no? Isn't there? We look back, you know, is this the same as it was 10 years ago? No. It's changed a lot. I think in medical science, I think after 7 or 10 years, I think you don't have one cell that's the same. I think, isn't that right or something?
7 years.
So, I mean, science has proven that. And of course, we just look at our mind and see how that's changing so much as well. So this can be very helpful in terms of the person, is to look at the basis of the person, the body and the mind. Because, you know, that's why we talk about this no self and this self-grasping, see, is that it seems like there is this sort of self that's undergoing all these physical and mental changes. There seems to be some thread there, doesn't it? You know, we say, I did this 10 years ago. I did this when I was young. As if there's somehow this I that's not really changing. Okay, the body and the mind might be changing, but me, it's the same me from like 10 years ago.
Right.
So then we sort of hold on to this me that seems to be not really changing. So to break that down, it can be helpful to understand that the me is simply on the basis of the body and the mind, and really focus on that.
I think I get that part. What confuses me is when we are seeing other human beings, I mean, with regards to relationships and all that. Like if I'm seeing someone attractive or non-attractive or attachment with that person, how do I see impermanence over there, which actually removes that attachment?
Yeah, I think I'll leave that because I'm sort of going to answer that in two different areas coming up in the text, in two different places in the text, so I'll leave it out because it involves a lot of other things, but it will be addressed.
No worries, thank you.
Yes, I mean, basically a realization of emptiness is a realization that everything is interdependent. And so to be in harmony with reality is to behave in a way of experientially seeing that everything is interdependent.
Yeah, but the state of mind cannot be very long. It can be maybe a few seconds. And then
for us now...
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to be fully in that state, almost impossible. What we can do now is be more in line with that. The first way we can be in line with that is to have ethical lifestyle. Because if we are unethical, we are definitely out of sync with reality. So at the foundation level, to be in harmony with reality at the very basic level is to have ethical lifestyle. To be in more harmony with that, we have the second practice of shamatha, the concentration practice. Because now, without our calm, clear, focused mind, a lot of mental afflictions are arising. We have a lot of attachments and aversions, which is completely out of harmony. So what you will find is by doing the concentration practice, the shamatha practice, then that manifest attachments and aversions will sort of die down a little bit because our mind is more focused. So in that sense, we'll be also more in harmony. But at the highest level is the wisdom practice, the wisdom of emptiness. As long as we are grasping onto me, 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 we are out of sync with reality. So now in our behavior, we're pretty well all the time grasping on me, 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 me.
So the state which is in harmony with reality is at the moment when you realize emptiness and before it's on the way.
Well, now...
Not in the state.
No, but we can have little glimpses of this now. Like, for example, particularly if we've done a little bit of shamatha practice and if we do the shamatha practice, see when we, in our actions, we tend to have the perspective of me going there, me saying this. It's always me, 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 me. And it's always on the basis of this self-grasping. Whereas if we have developed shamatha practice and we are engaging in behavior, we tend to be more focused on the activity rather than the me who's doing that thing. So the self-grasping you'll find is reduced. So in those behaviors where we have good focus, you'll find less self-grasping, less out of sync. You know, often people who really are focused talk about being in the zone or the flow state, and things seem to flow very well because we're more in sync with reality. But that's only due to the power of concentration. The self-grasping is a little bit reduced. What we need to do, of course, is eliminate the self-grasping altogether through the wisdom practice. So we can now, through our ethical lifestyle, through our shamatha practice, and through whatever little wisdom practice we have little taste of how to be in harmony. But to be fully in sync, it would require completely letting go of all self-grasping, which only happens when we go beyond samsara. But certainly as we progress towards that, we can start to have this little taste and experience which is somewhat similar to that state.
Is every practice which gives me this kind of flow state feeling a good practice?
No. Because I think a thief was probably in the flow state when they're cracking a safe. No? So no. That's why ethics has to be the basis of the concentration.
But if the practice doesn't hurt me or anybody else, in the moment, like, I like surfing.
Yeah.
It's got the feeling like, whoa.
Yeah, I think things like that can be very helpful. Because remember, like, for every practice, which is we're going to come to see very shortly, for any practice to be effective, we need two components. We need a meditation to internalize, and we need to do something the rest of the day, daily life. What's called, in the text here, is called subsequent period practices. So for any practice to be effective and progress, we need to both. So, shamatha practice, of course, in meditation is about strengthening mindfulness, developing single point concentration. And in daily life, any activity we do mindfully, of course, based on ethics again, then that is shamatha practice in daily life. So if that means to mindfully eat our food and taste it very nice, or mindfully surf through the waves, no difference. So those sorts of things, of course, anything we do with mindfulness in daily life can be very helpful for this practice. Of course, mindfully stealing someone's property is not one of those examples. That's why ethics has to be the basis.
Two types of happiness. The first one's temporal.
Sure.
The genuine, is that non-temporal?
Yeah. So genuine, because it's called temporal because it's stimulus-based, meaning for to have this happiness, what we call pleasure, we need a stimulus. Of course, that stimulus can be external or internal to the mind. It could be we remember something and then we have a pleasant experience. But we need a stimulus, which means when the stimulus finishes, the pleasure finishes. Whereas the genuine happiness is not stimulus-based. It does not require any particular thing to be present. Again, what it simply requires is to be in harmony with reality. What it means is to remove the contamination in our mind, the ignorance and mental afflictions. The more that we can remove that, the more in harmony we will be.
So, is it referring to Buddha nature?
Well, Buddha nature can be described slightly differently in different traditions. Buddha nature is really talking about the potential for enlightenment. And so Buddha nature, again, depending on the philosophical school we talk about, they describe that slightly differently. But yes, Buddha nature means we have the potential to eliminate all of these negativities from our mind.
Okay. But would it be described as blissful?
Yes, I mean, in certain traditions, particularly when we talk the Kagyu Nyingma school, we talk about Mahamudra Dzogchen, often Buddha nature is synonymous with this very subtle clear light mind. And of course that is beyond all conception and so forth. So yes, you could attribute those qualities to that. Whereas in other traditions, Buddha nature is described slightly differently. Like in the Geluk school, Buddha nature is really referring to the nature of the mind, the emptiness quality of the mind. So it's not really talking about that very subtle clear light mind. But they all imply the same ability.
You said that mention a lot the word reality.
Reality, yes.
And I take it that comes about through a realization of emptiness?
Correct, which is the very next topic.
I'm just wondering, it comes up in the course of conversation in everyday life. I'm wondering how we can, instead of just using the word, understand really and know when we see a reality.
Yes. And that's going to be, it's coming up very shortly. We're going to be talking about nature of reality. We're going to talk about this emptiness, what it is and how to cultivate it. So hopefully I'll be able to give you some information there. Let's see. Okay. Let's move now on to the next topic. So we're on page 90 in the commentary. Halfway down. And it says here, training in the two minds of awakening, the main practice. So again here, mind of awakening is a translation of bodhicitta. So citta is mind, bodhi is enlightenment, or sometimes bodhi enlightenment is the state of full awakening. So here, bodhicitta is translated as mind of awakening. So it says training in the two bodhicittas, the main practice. So remember, the two bodhicittas here is conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. So conventional bodhicitta is the compassion wing of the practice. It's this aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. Ultimate bodhicitta is the wisdom side of the practice, this realization of emptiness. So let's have a look at what this commentary says. But again, what I'd like to do to introduce this section of the practice, again, just read a little bit from Practice of Lojong here. So this is on page 29. He says the following. This point contains the actual practice of the cultivation of bodhicitta in formal meditation. This is the core of the Lojong teachings and the theme that runs through all its contemplations and practices. The Tibetan term for bodhicitta is jungchug gisem. We can translate this as enlightened heart, for jungchug means enlightenment and sem in this particular case means mind or heart. Jungchug carries two connotations. Chuk means possessing the attributes and qualities of enlightenment, and jung means freedom from defiling tendencies. So the Tibetan word for for body is jungchug. And this has two parts. Again, as he said here, the jung means to have purified negativities, and chug means to have developed all the positive qualities. So often the state of enlightenment is described in this way, of these two aspects, of having purified the mind completely of all negative tendencies and habits, and to have fully developed all the positive qualities of loving kindness and compassion. While we generally understand bodhicitta to be the benevolent concern for living beings, anyone who genuinely gives rise to it will possess both compassion and wisdom. The cultivation of bodhicitta has two aspects and two associated practices, which he calls absolute and relative, or what we've called conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. The traditional Mahayana analogy for the spiritual path is that it requires two wings to accomplish, just as a bird needs two wings to fly, the wings of wisdom and compassion. You could define absolute bodhicitta as the wisdom mind and relative bodhicitta as the cultivation of a compassionate heart. While relative and absolute bodhicitta are ultimately inseparable, it's important that we first learn to distinguish them. The Lojong teachings are predominantly concerned with the cultivation of relative bodhicitta, but we should never forget that absolute bodhicitta, or ultimate bodhicitta, is the main frame of reference and therefore the basis of our training. The cultivation of compassion is the veritable heart of the Lojong teachings. Compassion is not just about alleviating the suffering of others. It is also a powerful tool for effecting our own spiritual transformation. We must learn to be compassionately concerned about others, because that concern is what enables us to go beyond our discursive thoughts, conflicting emotions and self-obsessions, and break down the barriers created by ignorance, prejudice, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Okay. So let's now begin to look at the second of the 7 points, the main practice, practice of the two minds of awakening, the two bodhicittas, the wisdom and the compassion. Wisdom in terms of the wisdom of emptiness, compassion in terms of cultivating the mind of bodhicitta. So here in the commentary on page 90 it says, the second point, the training in the two minds of awakening, is the main practice. It has two parts, the ultimate mind and the conventional mind. So again, the ultimate mind here is ultimate bodhicitta, or the wisdom side of the practice, the emptiness practice, and the conventional mind, the conventional bodhicitta. Given the sequence in which meditative equipoise and post-meditation stages arise within a single person, these two minds are presented here in the following order. First, to train in the ultimate awakening mind, there are two parts: the actual meditation session and the subsequent period practices. So as I just briefly mentioned already, for any practice to be effective, for us to progress in any practice, it requires the two aspects of, here it says meditative equipoise, which is talking about the actual meditative practice, and then here what's called post-meditation, is, or subsequent period practices, is what do we do for the rest of the day between meditation sessions. Because if we meditate on something, even if we meditated on it every day, consistently every day, if we don't continue to cultivate what we've meditated on for the rest of the day, then whatever little benefit we've received in our meditation practice will sort of get squashed by our mindless running around in our old way of thinking and behaving. That will work against our meditation. So we need to continue to cultivate what we meditate on for the rest of the day. And that will then feed back into the meditation. So any practice always has these two parts: the meditation session and then what we do for the rest of the day. And that's called here the subsequent period practices. So for both the wisdom and compassion, then we're going to get some instructions now on how to meditate on wisdom and compassion and how to cultivate wisdom and compassion in daily life as well. And we're going to do it in the order of first looking at the meditation session and then what to do following that meditation session for the rest of the day. So, and it's doing it in the order of first the ultimate awakening mind, or the emptiness practice, the wisdom practice, then the compassion practice. Whereas what you will find in this book here is it reverses the order. Because this book was written as a result of a later commentary on this Lojong. So I think it was later in Tibetan Buddhism, it was felt as if it was more important to first develop the compassion side of practice than the wisdom side. Maybe, perhaps, because our self-cherishing mind was getting stronger and stronger. So therefore, we needed to really work on overcoming that first before the emptiness practice. But again, whether we are talking about the wisdom practice first here and then the compassion practice second, or the reverse order in this book, we're not suggesting, of course, that we need to fully develop our wisdom and then start the compassion practice. So we need to keep that in mind. We need to work on these two practices together. But here they're presented in this order: wisdom first, then compassion. So let's have a look now at the training in the ultimate awakening mind, the ultimate bodhicitta, or this wisdom of emptiness practice. And so the first part of this is the actual meditation session. So let's have a look at the commentary here. It says, the meditation session divides into three: preparatory practices, the main practice, and the concluding practice. And so now the next few sentences talks about how to prepare ourselves at the beginning of the meditation. It says, as for preparation, undertake the seven limb practice inside your chamber of divinities. Make supplications to meditational deities and your teachers, and having seated yourself comfortably on your meditation cushion, count your respiration, exhalation and inhalation 21 times. With these practices, you enable your body, speech and mind to become a fit vessel for meditative concentration. Then generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So this is how we prepare ourselves at the beginning of the meditation. So what I'd like to do is to have a look at that in a very clear, systematic way. Because I think this is very important. Of course, we need to prepare ourselves well for any activity we're doing. And sometimes, unfortunately, when people sit down to meditate, they just plop themselves down and then they start to meditate on compassion or emptiness or whatever they're doing without doing this preparation. And then usually the meditation doesn't go very well. So it's important to prepare ourselves well for every meditation. So I'd like to look at how to do that very systematically now based on what's being said in this paragraph. Because if we don't prepare ourselves well for meditation, then no matter how much effort you put into the actual practice, I think you'll probably find that you're not really going to receive the benefits. So generally, when we talk about preparing for meditation, we can talk about what's called the six preparations. And those of you who've studied the Lam Rim probably know this very well because it's very clearly laid out in the Lam Rim practices. The first thing we need to do to prepare ourselves well for the meditation is to clean the place, meaning we should have a very comfortable and clean place to meditate. So, you know, if we just sort of flop down on our bed to meditate, then of course the bed is usually something we use to sleep on, so we sit on the bed, it may just send a signal to it's time for having a nice little snooze. So, generally it's recommended, if possible, at home, if you have a large enough place, to have a separate room for meditation. And only have that for meditation. And then you can also close the door, of course, make it more quiet. Of course, if we don't have the luxury of a spare room to use for meditation, at least we should reserve a corner of the room for meditation. So make it so that there is a place where you only use for meditation purposes. And make it comfortable and attractive and clean. So it's inviting. So that you want to go there. And also what you'll find, of course, is if where we meditate is very cluttered and full of rubbish and so forth, that sort of really disturbs the mind. It's not very good for the mind. So if we can really have a very nice, clean place, this is very good for the state of mind as well. So if we can then really find a place, a little separate place for meditation and use that only for meditation, meaning whenever we go into that space, we associate that space with meditation. So that's going to be very helpful as well, to put our mind in that frame of mind of meditating, because that is the place we meditate. Just like the bed is a place where we sleep. So it's good then to have that place and to really make sure it's nice and clean and inviting and comfortable. So that's the first thing we need to prepare. then often it's recommended as a second step is what's called make offerings. Because also it's quite traditional to have what's called like an altar. And we can put some offerings on this altar, as we see here, for example. So also on this altar, it can be very helpful to put a picture, if we have a personal teacher, to put a picture of the teacher there, because then when we see our teacher, hopefully that will inspire us to practice. If we don't have a teacher, then we can put a picture of someone who really inspires us, maybe the Dalai Lama or Lama Tsongkhapa or Shakyamuni Buddha, someone within the tradition, maybe a Tisha, or if we're following a particular practice. So we can use that as to inspire us in our practice. Also, you find commonly, but it's not here so much, on an altar in the Tibetan tradition, you have often a statue in the middle, and then you have a stupa on the right and a text on the left. This is symbolizing body, speech, and mind of enlightened being. So symbolizing the body is the statue, the stupa is symbolizing the mind, and the text is symbolizing the speech. So this can also be helpful because by seeing them, that hopefully would inspire us to develop body, speech, and mind of enlightened being. So that can also be something we can put on the altar. And then in the Tibetan tradition, and this is coming from the Indian tradition, to make offerings. And here we are on this, we see seven bowls. And sometimes on the end you see a little shell, a big shell actually, a conch shell. So traditionally there were eight things that were offered. Because historically in ancient India, if an important guest came to your house, you would offer eight things to them, traditionally, to make them welcome. First, of course, you would give them some water to have a drink. You would offer some water so they could wash their hands and their feet. So we have the washing and drinking. Then often there is offering of flowers, offering of incense, some nice smelling incense. Usually there's an offering of light. Then offering of perfume to scent their body. And then you would offer some food and music. So that makes eight offerings, which usually are sort of symbolized in the Tibetan tradition by bowls such as these. So often you'll see seven bowls, and then at the end you'll see a shell, big shell, which is like a conch shell, which is symbolizing the music. And then sometimes in the bowls, instead of water in the middle one, you'd see some rice with a little candle or some incense sticks. So then you can symbolize the various offerings. So the idea being here, of course, to make these offerings is to really develop our generosity, to help us to develop generosity. Remember in the Mahayana, the first of the six perfections is generosity. And the reason that that practice is listed first is because it's the easiest thing to do, particularly material generosity. So to make these offerings before we meditate starts to help us to develop the mind of generosity. And particularly also, of course, if we have a picture of our teacher or the Buddha or someone like that on the altar behind that, we can imagine doing these offerings for them. So this is what is typically done at the start of the meditation, again, to really cultivate the mind of generosity. The third point is that we sit down and we prepare body, speech, and mind and develop a good motivation. So all of those activities from taking the seat through to developing the motivation of bodhicitta. In the commentary, it's sort of listed in a little bit different order, but this is the more traditional order. So let's have a look at this third point. So the first part is to find a nice comfortable posture. And again, with posture, the most important thing, there are two things that are important with posture. One is to have the body completely relaxed, and then the second point is to keep the back nice and straight. So they're the two main criteria with the posture. On top of that, of course, you can look at the various aspects of the posture, which I won't go into detail. But the idea being that we should get into a physical posture whereby our body is very stable and it does not create any interference in our meditation. So, of course, historically, with the legs, it was considered the full lotus position was the best. But I think in our Western society, we didn't grow up sitting cross-legged, and so for many of us, that's sort of impossible. But if you can do full lotus, of course, that's very stable base, and it's a good posture to be in. If you can't do that, you can do like what's called half lotus, or simply cross your legs. Sometimes when people cross their legs, they find their legs sort of fall asleep. To avoid that, sometimes people use what's called the Burmese posture, where instead of crossing the legs, you have one in front of the other. So that's also something you can experiment with. Ideally, it would be good to have both knees touching, and so you have three points of contact, very stable. Not so good to sit sort of like this, because then it's not very stable, and often when the knees are higher than the hips, it really puts a lot of strain on the lower back. So people who sit like this often have a lot of lower back pain and pain in the groin here. So that's not a good situation. So if you're sitting like this, it usually means we're very stiff in the hips. We need more cushions. So have enough cushions so that the knees are at least level with the hips and not higher than the hips. Ideally, the knees should be touching, because then you have three points of contact. If they're not, you can also put a little cushion under each knee, and that can make it very stable. So what you should find is that you should have enough cushions so that your back is naturally straight. If you're always finding that you're sort of doing this to straighten the back, it means that you've not got enough cushions, you know, because then you'll strain your lower back. So more cushions so that you sit and you find that your back is more naturally straight. Now, of course, some people have knee problems, damaged knees, can't even sit cross-legged. Then, of course, we can use a meditation stool like these here, where you tuck your legs under the stool. This can also be very useful posture. Some people find that that doesn't work. Then you can sit in a chair. That's equally good, no problem. Some people have back problems, and even sitting in a chair is painful. Of course, if we're sitting in a chair, we need to make sure the feet are flat. Again, that we have sitting flat and that the back is nice and straight and not sort of slouching in the chair. That's not going to work. We're just going to fall asleep when we meditate. So if you're sitting in a chair and you find these chairs probably are not ideal for meditation. If you find that you're slouching a bit, you can put a cushion behind your back or underneath, so you're sort of more upright. Some people find that they have back problems, and even sitting in a chair is painful. So if you really do have back problems, you can also lie down and meditate. This is, you know, in yoga, we call it the Shavasana, the corpse posture, lying flat on the back, arms to the side. So this can also be a valid meditation posture, particularly if we have back problems. Personally also, I use that posture a lot when I do meditation retreat, because if you're sitting in meditation retreat and you're sitting in this posture for many hours each day, then, you know, often I find by towards the end of the day my knees are starting to ache a little bit. I'm getting a bit fatigued. Then now in retreat, generally in the evening sessions, I always meditate lying down. And I find it very relaxing, and actually surprised how alert I can maintain my meditation lying down. If you're using that posture for meditation, I would recommend to have the eyes open. And I personally found that after I got used to it, I find that that meditation posture works very well. I can really stay very alert and at the same time be completely relaxed. So again, if you have some back problems or you're doing some retreat and you're getting a little bit sore knees or so forth, you might like to experiment with that possibility as well. With the hands, in the Tibetan tradition, usually it's recommended you have your right palm in the left, your thumbs touching, resting in your lap. And this is symbolic of wisdom, compassion, and the fact that we need to practice them together. But if you don't find that comfortable, then you can just have your hands on your knees. Doesn't really matter so much. And again, just completely relaxed. The eyes, of course, the back nice and straight. If we're sort of sitting here like this, then of course we're going to probably get very dull and sleepy. So have the back nice and straight so all the subtle energies can flow very well in the body. Head position, not too high, not too low. Should be sort of, if you've got your eyes open, you should be sort of looking slightly downward. And with the eyes, generally it's recommended to have them slightly open, because if we have them closed, that's usually a sign that we want to go to sleep and we get very drowsy. If we have them too open, we may get too much light, may agitate. But again, this is something you can experiment with. And also when you're at home, of course, you can experiment with the amount of light in the room. Personally, I like it quite dim, but that's something you can experiment with as well. But again, the most important thing with the posture is the two things, is body completely relaxed and the back is nice and straight. So that's a little bit about the posture. Any question about the posture?
Actually, I've tried meditating at home. I find it very difficult to keep track of time, in the sense that I thought that I've been meditating for half an hour and I look at the watch and it's 5 minutes. And then the reverse happens, that I felt that it was 5-10 minutes, but I'm late for whatever I wanted to because I've been sitting there for...
Use a clock. Use a timer.
I kept doing that, so I kept looking at the watch every 5 minutes. As if, you know...
Well, what you can do, of course, is you can have a clock, but don't have it facing you. So then there's no temptation to look at what time it is, and you know that it's going to an alarm. So you set an alarm, a timer. Set a timer, and then, see, this is something very important for meditation, to do this, because otherwise what happens is, if we don't set a timer, is on days when things are not going very well, we just stop, we give up. So then we remain the slaves of our mind and we don't develop any perseverance in our practice. And equally well, on days where it's going well, what the tendency can be is to keep meditating because it's going well today. But then what do we usually do? We keep going until when it starts to go bad and then we stop. The thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending in agitation, distraction and dullness, we associate meditation with these sorts of experiences. We're not going to want to meditate again. So if we have a timer, then set the timer, which means even on days when things are not going well, we'll persevere until the time is up. So that will help with our perseverance. Also on days where things are going well, then when the timer goes, we stop. And we stop on a good experience, that's what we remember. We will want to meditate again the next day because we remember the good experience. So it's very important to have a fixed time for those reasons.
And recommended time is 15, 20 minutes? Or is it...
There is no exact, I mean, recommended time. The recommended time is based on the expression quality over quantity. So it's much better to meditate 20 minutes in a focused way than 1 hour allowing ourselves to get caught up in dullness and distraction. Because that 1 hour, we're just increasing our bad habits, so that it's actually useless to do that. Whereas if we really put effort for 20 minutes, we're developing new better habits. So how long to meditate depends on us as an individual. One guideline is... that's often mentioned in the text is your enthusiasm to meditate should be the same at the end as it was the beginning of the session. If your enthusiasm to meditate is dropping off, you're meditating too long. But as a sort of ballpark figure for many beginners, 20, 25 minutes can be a good amount of time. And that's sort of what we're doing in these classes here.
And the other issue is with being sleepy. Even in the morning when I'm completely fresh, and I don't think I should fall sleepy while trying to meditate, I get a slightly groggy feeling while I'm meditating.
Right, yeah. So, of course, prevention is the best cure. So part of preventing sleepiness, and this is something I think that's very important in our modern society, is get enough sleep. Because I think in many people, in Western society at least, suffer from sleep deprivation because, you know, they're so busy, they haven't got time to do everything. So where do they cut the corner? They cut their sleep, less sleep. And then, of course, they're sleep deprivation. That is not going to, we're not going to be able to meditate in that state. So we need to get enough sleep. Of course, we need to make sure that we have a healthy diet because unhealthy diet, a lot of junk food, a lot of sugar is going to create a lot of agitation and problems in meditation as well. We need to make sure that we're not meditating after heavy meals. And where we meditate, we need to make sure that it's not too hot, stuffy or dark. So, you know, don't put too much clothing on to meditate because you'll just sort of get sleep. And again, the posture, back nice and straight. If the back is like this or the head is down, of course we're going to get sleepy. And again, keep the sessions short. Also, on top of that, people have different dispositions in terms of when they're most alert in the day. And even in the meditation text, they talk about these different types of people. Personally, my experience is from doing meditation retreat, the time generally where I'm most alert is from about 3:30 in the afternoon till 9 p.m. But for most of us, of course, if we have a working life and we want to do a daily meditation practice, trying to do it in the evening is probably not going to work. We're going to be tired, social commitments, something important on TV, you know, not going to work. So we need to, for most of us, we'll need to do it early in the morning. And of course, also, it's a good way to start the day. If we find that we're a little bit drowsy in the morning, then, you know, have a shower, have a cup of tea, even a cup of coffee, as long as it's not too strong and agitating. So these things also we can do before we sit down to meditate in the morning. But again, keep the session short. Okay, afternoon tea time, so let's have a cup of tea and come back at 3:30 and we'll continue on these preparatory practices.